If someone asks, who are you? You might answer something like this.
My name is Maya Ludke. I am 19 years old, and I'm currently a student at Wellesley College.
But that's not all Maya is. Identity is a complex thing. We're all more than just our names or ages or genders, our ethnicities, professions, and passions, our religions and relationships. Different strands weave together in different ways over time. For most of human history, most people's identities were defined by their clan, their community, their tribe. They didn't have a whole lot of choice in the matter. In the 21st century, there's arguably more room than at any time in history to construct an identity, to choose what about it matters most to us, and how we most want others to see us. Of course, getting there takes some work. This is Whose Century Is It?, a podcast about ideas, trends, and twists shaping the 21st century. I'm Mary Kay Magstead. And this is a story that begins before Maya Ludke was Maya Ludke. Before she was Maya, she was an abandoned baby girl in eastern China when the one-child policy and a traditional preference for boys landed her in an orphanage. There, they named her Chang Yu Lu. That was around the same time that human rights reports about orphanages in China painted them as grim places where many of the babies died of neglect. But this orphanage wasn't like that. It opened up to foreigners who wanted to adopt. One of them was a former sports journalist named Melissa Ludke. As a young woman, Melissa had successfully sued for the right to interview male athletes in the men's locker room. She argued that it was unfair competition, that her male colleagues could do it and she couldn't. As a single woman in her mid-40s, now editor of Nieman Reports at Harvard, where I first met her 15 years ago, she pushed through another boundary.
I had very much thought about having a child. I had, in fact, gone and tried to have a child on my own after a relationship ended for me in my late 30s. And I then was into my 40s and still single and still without a child. And it was a friend of mine who asked me a question one day. She said, so I guess you've decided you won't be a mother, since she figured I hadn't acted on it by this point. And I responded to her immediately, no, I haven't decided that.
The friend helped connect Melissa with an adoption agency. And months later, the abandoned baby girl, Chang Yu Lu, in eastern China, became cherished adopted daughter Maya Ludke, growing up in Cambridge, Massachusetts.
Growing up, yes, I knew I was adopted. I knew that I was born in China, raised in America, and I guess I considered myself, you know, American Chinese, but I didn't really think deeper than that. I really felt what that meant for me and where I connected with being Chinese and where I felt that I was more American.
Melissa tried to keep Maya connected with China. So did many of the other parents of adopted Chinese babies. Maya was part of a huge wave of Chinese adoptions, some 80,000 into the United States, 40,000 elsewhere. Many of the adoptive parents stayed in touch. They even organized into more formal groups. And the daughters, mostly daughters, met often.
We began to provide language lessons for our kids.
This is Melissa.
We began to offer them dance instruction. We looked for opportunities in Chinatown in Boston to engage them in activities there.
The idea was not to repeat the mistakes of a previous generation of parents who'd adopted Korean kids and felt the best thing for their sense of identity was to leave the Korean part behind.
I learned an immense amount from listening to the experiences of the Korean adoptees who at that point were entering college and beyond. They were no longer in their families, but yet they were talking very honestly about the experiences they'd had growing up, primarily, interestingly, in the Midwest, where the notion was that once they came into a family, that was who they were. They were no different than the family members. You know, no one talked about the fact that they were Korean and that they might look different, they might act differently, that they might have different sensibilities that they might bring to themselves based on what they looked at in the mirror every day and what they knew about themselves as being different. What we learned as a community of adoptive parents from China really instructed us to engage our kids in activities that would give them a sense of who they were very early on.
Which, Maya says now, worked to a point.
So it was great to have that community of other girls that were in the same kind of boat as me. But, I mean, yeah, of course, growing up, there's moments when, you know, maybe I was a bit embarrassed because my family wasn't what everyone else's was, and people would ask questions, and I didn't always know how to respond when people asked me, oh, that's really your mom.
I'm talking to Maya and Melissa in their living room in a cozy second-floor apartment in Cambridge. A couple of cats are snuggled up nearby. Maya and Melissa have a story to tell about the search for identity, and they've decided to tell it in a new multimedia project called Touching Home in China. The sound you heard earlier of crying babies in the orphanage is from a video in that project from when Melissa went to adopt Maya in 1997. The sound in this video is from a little later.
Can you tell them we've come here to say thank you for taking good care of her?
It shows Maya as an overwhelmed 7-year-old in the police station in the town where she was born, Shaanxi in Jiangsu province. It was Maya's first time back to China since she'd been adopted.
Thank you.
Melissa thought it would be a good idea to walk around the town itself, the town where Maya might have grown up if her birth family had kept her.
And we went into the marketplace there. And as we walked around, it became clear to me that the entire marketplace had basically stopped and everyone was staring at us, mostly at me with the blonde hair. I was truly an alien. And there I was holding the hand of a young girl. I don't know, maybe they thought that I had kidnapped her. I don't think they couldn't possibly understand how she and I came to be together. And this made Maya so uncomfortable.
It must have made you uncomfortable.
It made both of us uncomfortable. And yet we had this long circle to kind of go around in order to get out of the marketplace. I had really done a bad job that morning of being her mother in the way that I should have been. And we went back to Changzhou and just stayed in the hotel room the rest of the day. That moment left a very, very strong imprint on me. And it was really there a decade later when I suggested to her that it was really time to think about going home on her own.
Well, kind of on her own. At age 16, Maya went with a friend her age, another adopted Chinese girl who'd been adopted out of the same orphanage at the same time. And then there was the film crew that Melissa arranged to follow them as they went back to their places of birth and tried to find a way to connect, to see what the lives of girls their age there was like, what their lives might have been like if their families had kept them. Here, Maya's trying to talk to one of the local women in Shaanxi. The woman is asking, "Do you understand when we speak to you in Chinese?" Maya understands some, but not all, and the women seem perplexed. She looks like a Shaanxi girl. Why does she talk funny? Why can't she understand basic Chinese?
Yeah. I mean, if I didn't say anything, you know, I blended in perfectly. And then, you know, the confusion was hit about why I sounded so weird. Or back in Changzhou, kind of the bigger city, we went to this really strange underground mall. Me and Jenny, my crewmate from the orphanage, we were trying to talk to this shop lady. And she kind of started saying, "Are you making fun of me? Are you trying to, like, play a joke on me? Like, why are you speaking this way? Like, do you think my Chinese is funny?"
And did anyone chew you out for not having better Chinese? Because this has happened to a lot of my Chinese-American friends, including some who were in my initial Chinese language course. They're like, you know, I mean, come on, have some respect for your culture.
Yeah, there was definitely some confusion when I first arrived. You know, I'm one of the only foreigners they've ever seen, which was kind of strange for me.
It's striking to me how Maya describes herself here, a foreigner. She was one of the only foreigners they'd ever seen. But she was from there. She was clearly ethnically Chinese. In China, all of this can be confusing. If America is the land of constructed identities, China is one where many people consider identity immutable, especially Chinese identity. If you're ethnically Chinese, even if you're generations removed, you're Chinese. And if you're not ethnically Chinese, You will never be Chinese, no matter how perfectly you speak the language, how well you know the culture, or how much you consider China to be home. Let me bring in another voice here for some context. This is Mei Fong, a former Wall Street Journal correspondent in China.
You know, I was raised in Malaysia. We spoke Cantonese at home, but we didn't speak Mandarin. And I also didn't learn how to write in Chinese. We learned Malay in schools. Malay was our first language of instruction in English. But I spoke Chinese at home. We had Chinese food. But when I went to China, you know, in some sense, I wasn't considered Chinese enough because I didn't, you know, I wasn't fluent in Mandarin. And I didn't know all the dynasties. But at the same time, the minute I did anything controversial in the way of a story, I was held to a higher account than, say, my white colleagues. They would say, you are a traitor because you have written something bad against the Chinese people. Like somehow I was supposed to uphold the principles and the values more because of my Chinese face and my Chinese ethnic heritage. So I think there's a lot of toggling between back and forth of, are you enough of this? Are you not enough of this? And I think one of the problems is that China, by definition, tries to sort of hold itself as the standard. You know, we say what's Chinese. Mm. We say, you know, Mandarin is Chinese. We say simplified writing is Chinese. And this is, you know, as part of the assertion of their rising, you know, identity as a global power.
Mei Fong has been thinking a lot about identity in China, especially about female identity. She just wrote a book about China's one-child policy called One Child, China's Most Radical Experiment. She says she can relate to the unwanted girls in China. Her own father, the 16th of 18 sons, by the same father, different mothers, was aghast that he had 5 daughters and no sons.
My father certainly was very, very disappointed. You know, he had grown up in a household which had been defined by sons. It had a very proud lineage. And, you know, he kept having daughters. His brothers had sons, but he had one after the other was a daughter. And so he was an accountant, and he would speak in that terminology. So one of the things he quite frequently kept telling us was, you know, you guys are liabilities. You are not assets. You are liabilities. Don't forget that.
So you went back to the family seat in Guangdong, mm-hmm. and you found that in terms of how the family remembered family members who were no longer living within China, it was different for boys and girls, men and women.
Oh, yeah. They remembered the boys. My father had never stepped a foot in China, but they knew who he was. All I had to do was go there and say, I am number 16 son, and they could place me. They knew exactly who I was in the genealogy. But when I asked about the daughters, my father's sisters, how many sisters did he have? How many daughters did my grandfather have? They didn't know. they didn't count them, he said. And that's what my cousin told me. He said, they don't count. Girls don't count.
Because they're liabilities.
Liabilities, not assets. Yeah.
It was attitudes like that within China that led to some 50 million missing girls over the 30-plus years of the one-child policy. Girls who were selectively aborted or abandoned or killed or hidden so families could try again. For a boy. So, no surprise here, unintended consequences abound. For starters, there are now way more boys than girls, more young men than young women in the one-child generation. That makes it hard for some of these young men to find wives now that some of them are looking. Mei Fong, for her research, went to what was called a bachelor village, a place where the young men were having a really hard time finding wives.
And when I showed up at the village, I was very curious, what is a bachelor village in China like? Is it full of lonely, morose, you know, men lurking around? Is violence a real possibility? I was a bit nervous about that, so I asked our paper's only male researcher to come with me. I didn't want to be, you know, in a dangerous situation, but I discovered that all these villages are basically like any other village in China, which is to say it's mostly filled with old people and children. Because you can't make a living on a farm now. Everybody has to go and work out in the city. So all the young men, all the young women go. The only difference is the young women go and they stay gone. There's nothing to attract them back, very few of them back, because they have no inheritance rights. But the men stand to inherit the family properties. So, and they care about continuing the family line. So they had to find wives, and their MO was to find a woman and dump her back in the village so she would have his children, take care of his parents, and take care of the family plot.
So in one family, the son found a bride, but then got ditched. The bride was just too darn bored in the village.
I remember going to visit that family. It was a very small, sort of a courtyard-oriented kind of a place. And right in the middle, smack dab, sitting there was a motorcycle in the living room. And it was a bright red motorcycle with beautiful little ribbons tied to the handles. And this had been a gift to the bride that had run away. And he was very stricken. He really felt something for her, he said. And he said she had actually called him after she had run away and apologized and said this was something she had to do. I felt sorry for him because, you know, this is not obviously a situation of their making. And I remember talking to some of the other parents whose sons had been dumped as well. And I remember talking to one of them, and he was bemoaning the fact that, you know, now his first son's wife had decamped. They had borrowed all this money for his bride price. And now he had a second son waiting in the wings, and he didn't know where he was going to scrape the money for his second son's bride price. And he said to me, you know what? I wish I had daughters. I wish I had daughters. And there was a part of me that went, yes!
Attitudes about women and girls in China have been changing fast as China modernizes. Over the 15 years I lived there as a foreign correspondent, I could see the change. More women were going to college, getting good jobs, making good money, and often staying in better touch with their parents than their male counterparts were. In different conversations over time, many parents told me they were glad they had girls. The grandparents might be more vocal in expressing their disappointment, but the parents were fine with it. Back in Shaxi Village, where Maya was born, there was a young woman whose grandfather had been similarly disappointed that she was a girl. He died when she was a baby. That girl, Yuan Mengping, is now a college graduate. A video in Touching Home in China shows her talking with her mother and grandmother while Maya looks on. It's clear she feels loved, accepted, and empowered to make of her life what she will.
She is very open. Her mind is very open. So I think I'm very lucky and happy.
But Maya says there were other girls in Shaxi who didn't seem to feel as supported by their parents.
And a lot of the girls were not living with their parents. You know, a lot were living with aunts and uncles and grandparents. Or some didn't have connections with their parents like that closely.
Sometimes this was because the parents had gone to bigger cities to work and send home money. In other cases, divorce or death of a parent led to kids, both boys and girls, being passed on to grandparents or other relatives. Millions of Chinese children in rural areas have grown up this way. That was kind of an eye-opener for Maya, the realization that even if she'd stayed in China, she might not have been raised by her parents. When we talked, she kept her feelings about her biological parents kind of close to her chest. What she said is she didn't want to find them. Not now, anyway.
I did not do a birth parent search. But actually, there was one day when I was with one of the girls that I met, and she kind of out of the blue said, oh, there's the hospital. That's where I was born. Maybe you were born there, too. So, of course, you know, went inside. And, of course, all the doctors, like, stopped what they were doing to come see this strange foreigner who said she was born here.
Again, Maya makes this reference to herself as a strange foreigner, even though she was from Shaxi, possibly literally born in that hospital.
And they started digging through these old shelves of records and looking at computer records to see, you know, how many babies came through that day and how many were kind of unidentified. And so we spent quite a long time there. So that was probably the closest, I guess, that I came to actually doing something.
How did it feel to be there?
In the hospital?
Yeah.
Kind of overwhelming.
Meifeng says she's heard a lot of mixed feelings from adoptees born in China, now being raised as Americans.
A lot of adoptees that I talked to expressed a sense of loss. And these were the older adoptees, because a majority of the children adopted from China are still in their teens. So many of them are still struggling also. So some of them actually don't want to know about China so much. They want to assimilate. So it's an issue for them.
These are girls, mostly girls, who have been raised by loving parents, some with considerable resources, in a land of opportunity. Many are told, and for many it's true, that their lives are far better than they would have been in China. But China's changed a lot since these girls were born. Who knows what their lives would actually have been like in China? One of the girls Maya met during her visit 3 years ago in Shaxi Village is now going to college at Syracuse in New York. Many of those parents who went off to cities to work saved money so their kids could have a better life, and now they're having it. It is true that back in the mid-90s, when Maya was adopted, Chinese orphanages were filled with abandoned girls. And presumably, the American parents who adopted them thought they were doing a good thing, giving these girls better lives. But there was a dark side to what was happening. The Chinese government had imposed the one-child policy, both to reduce population growth and to speed China's economic ascent. In fact, the two were linked. Fewer people meant a higher GDP per capita. Fewer children per family meant each family would pour more resources into that child, leading to a more educated, advanced workforce. And that pretty much happened. But in the process, Mei Fong says, the Chinese government made it hard for abandoned Chinese kids to be adopted by Chinese families within China.
If you were a foreigner, you could adopt a child in China much easier than a person in China who's Chinese would try to do, because the Chinese deliberately made their own citizens second class in terms of the whole adoption process. They didn't want people trying to pass off their second or third children as adopted children. So if you were a Chinese person and you wanted to adopt, that would be your quota regardless. You couldn't adopt a child and still give birth to your own in many cases.
And then in the late 90s, as ultrasound machines became more ubiquitous in China so mothers could find out the gender of their babies and abort early, more families got the boys they wanted and fewer girls were available for adoption. Even once the government made it illegal to tell mothers the gender of their babies, doctors would get around it for a fee, nodding if it was a boy, coughing if it was a girl.
And as a result, that fewer girls were born, and there were fewer infants that were abandoned. And so the supply dried up. But at the same time, the demand was still there, and not more to the point. The institutions set up to supply that demand were there. All these orphanages had grown used to receiving money from overseas adoptions. There was these agencies, workers, so on and so forth. And so, of course, predictably enough, trafficking came into the picture.
By about a decade ago, stories were starting to emerge about Chinese orphanages buying children. The Chinese government tightened up restrictions for what kind of foreigners could adopt. The era of easy Chinese adoptions fast came to an end. China had become relatively affluent. Social expectations had shifted, perhaps even more than the government anticipated. The fertility rate dropped to well below replacement. And so, now, as of late last year, the one-child policy is no more. Now the government says everyone can have two children, after they fill in the right paperwork. But, funny thing, turns out it's harder to turn on the tap than to turn it off. 30 years of coercion, forced abortion, sterilization, and intrusiveness into people's private lives have left their mark. Many young adults, enjoying good jobs and decent money, are staying single longer and opting to have just one child or no children once they get married. They say raising children is hard and expensive, and anyway, they were only children. Why have more than one? This is yet another unintended consequence, which is going to have an impact in shaping this century for China. Here's another. China's baby boom generation is hitting retirement, and their only children are now tasked with keeping a slowing economy humming along while supporting an ever-growing older population. There's a question that's been asked so often it's become something of a cliché. Will China grow old before it grows rich? Will it hit the kind of per capita GDP that developed countries have, which was, after all, one of the goals of the one-child policy? Or will it get stuck in what's called the middle income trap? At this point, not at all clear. Still, Maya says the girl she got to know in the town where she was born seemed proud to be Chinese at a time when China has been rising in the world.
Some of the girls were very happy living in China. They want to stay there. But at the same time, there was a reoccurring, topic of, oh, you're so lucky to live in America. Everything is perfect. Like, you don't have to work hard. Like, school is easy. All these things. Which is true. I mean, I am very fortunate, to be where I am and to be in school and going to college now. But it's also kind of, unsettling to hear that there's such this, perfect image of what America's like.
So now you two together are doing this series of multimedia books and a curriculum for kids to learn, in part from your experience, but about broader issues as well. What would you like school kids to be able to learn?
don't know. I hope that the students are able to take away from my story and be able to relate it to their own lives, and kind of learn that this is like your own personal journey and your own story. You kind of have to take it for yourself. You can't always have other people telling you this is what you are. And it's really your own kind of identity to form about who you are and who you want to be, and kind of having that sense of how you want to be defined.
So what's most important to you now about your identity? If someone said, what are you? And it could be anything. It does, you know, it doesn't necessarily have to be American or Chinese or whatever. What's the first thing that would come to mind?
That's right. Yeah, that's interesting. I mean, I still think that I am Chinese American, you know, because I have become American. But I still do feel tied to China. I know, I guess instead of just saying I'm like half Chinese and half American, it's kind of more thinking about in what areas you feel Chinese and what areas you feel American. And I think growing up for me, like, that changed day to day. Like, there were some days where I felt like I wanted to be more connected to China, and there were some days where I wanted to feel more American. So I don't know, I think it's really a sliding scale, and it's hard to really say. Yeah.
You're writing about, thinking about, with this project, issues of identity and immigration and feelings of acceptance or lack thereof. And in the midst of all this, the Republican presidential campaign is playing out, and you're hearing all kinds of stuff coming from the candidates. Fear and suspicion of outsiders, particularly certain sorts of outsiders. But I'm just kind of wondering how you're reacting to that in the midst of working on this project.
One of the places that I'm really hoping that this story goes and our curriculum is able to illuminate and draw out discussion on these topics is particularly at community colleges. We're talking now in this country about the really need to strengthen the community college system. And it really is the gateway for so many immigrants from all over America into both our society and into higher education. That I think that Maya and Jenny's experience of trying to, in a sense, return to a place to understand yourself better raises so many of these questions that every immigrant who comes to this country who is thought of as other and begins to think of themselves as other until they find pathways to understanding how other becomes us. I think this story can be a powerful tool to help them to do that. So as I think about what I hear from many of the Republican candidates, I can't help but hope that not only our story, but there are other tools that, you know, that immigrants who are feeling as though they are being thought of by people in our country as being other, when what they want to be is part of us, this can be something that can be a resource.
How about you?
I haven't been following as much as I maybe should be or would like to be.
From your own personal experience growing up here, have you ever been made to feel like other, like that people were viewing you as not being American in the same way that other people were?
Yeah, sometimes. I think so. Yeah. Being Chinese, you were definitely kind of looked at differently sometimes. About, you know, foreigners taking jobs and foreigners, you know, like, oh, there's so many Asians all the time. And yeah, sometimes it makes me feel a little bit kind of different and stuff. But I mean, I think overall I can say I felt pretty like included, I guess.
Maya still seems to be figuring out where she fits into all this. She plans to beef up her Chinese while in college. She's interested in the environment and could see going back to the land of her birth to help on that front for a while. But when her mom tells me there are a lot of mainland Chinese students at Wellesley, and I ask if she has much interaction with them, she seems slightly annoyed that I would assume such a thing.
Yeah, I mean, I know a few girls that are from mainland China. There's two girls actually in my dorm, they're roommates, but I haven't really interacted with them much. Mm. I mean, yeah, there definitely is a, you know, significant amount of Asian students at the school. That's something I've noticed, but it's not something that I really have thought about that much.
You haven't made a point of trying to connect with them or...
Yeah. I mean, I don't know where to call students there. I don't really look at kind of where all the different agencies are from. Yeah.
Yeah.
Perhaps this is all part of figuring out the fine balance of identity. Maya thought of herself as a foreigner in the place of her birth, as American Chinese in a home with a Caucasian mother, and as just another American when it came to interacting, or not, with students from China on her campus. Perhaps we all do this a little at different points in our lives. Find common ground when we want it, differentiate ourselves when we need to. America, more than most places, allows for that modulation. Sure, real differences exist, racism persists, and it can be harder for some people than for others to have that fluidity. But boundaries can be broken and identities redefined. Perhaps the first step is to know yourself. Maya is on that journey. And that's our podcast. If you'd like to check out Touching Home in China, it's at touchinghomeinchina.com. And it's not just about Maya's experience. It's also about the lives of women and girls in China and the challenges they face, about the one-child policy, about immigration, identity, demography, and a lot of other interesting topics. Thanks to Melissa and Maya Ludke for sharing their story, and to Mei Fong, author of One Child, for helping to put the one-child policy in perspective. There's also more on our webpage, pri.org/century, including links to all 12 episodes so far of Whose Century Is It? You can also find us and subscribe on iTunes. We're also on SoundCloud, Stitcher, and on most podcast apps. I tweet at Mary Kay Magstad, that's MaryKayMagistad, all one word. Whose Century Is It? Is a co-production between me and PRI's The World in collaboration with the BBC and WGBH. We're funded by a grant from the Henry Luce Foundation. We'll be back in a couple of weeks with a new episode. Join us. Oh.